This is a session on faith and science education. Is that where you meant to be?
Yes.
Good. Then the first paper will be presented by Andrew Walsh. Andrew is with Health Monitoring, and his paper is entitled Beaming Science Fiction into the Science and Faith Conversation.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming out on a sunny Sunday afternoon. So I'm Andy Walsh. I do work for Health Monitoring. It's my day job in a public health software company. And I also blog for InterVarsity and their Emerging Scholars Network, and have a book that you might have seen over on the table. I'll talk about that a little bit later. I'm talking today about beaming science fiction into science and faith conversation, a little bit about how we can use science fiction stories as maybe to help people introduce people to different topics. And hopefully, the idea that science fiction stories are useful in and of themselves is not something that needs a lot of introduction, but maybe some of the examples in particular will be helpful. And since this year is the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein, I thought that was an interesting place to start. So Mary Shelley published it at the beginning of 1818, initially published not under her name because of reasons, 1818. And really, you know, opened up in a lot of ways the science fiction genre in general, launched all kinds of movies, plays, books, all sorts of things that spun out of the Frankenstein myth and story, including a whole genre on Twitter now of pedantry, reminding people that actually the monster's name was Frankenstein's monster. It was the doctor who was Frankenstein. And so if you make that mistake on Twitter, it won't take very long before someone will correct you. And of course, Frankenstein has applications for discussion of all sorts in humanities classes. We talk about whether there should be limits to human ambition. Did Dr. Frankenstein go too far in what he was trying to achieve? What are the defining qualities of humanity? Is Frankenstein's monster an example of a human? If not, what is he? How do we relate to him? How do we treat those who are different in general? Should there be limits to scientific experimentation? Why might we need limits to scientific experimentation? And you might be familiar, this is a conversation that continues today, and the topic of Frankenstein is never far from that discussion. So these are just a few headlines that I pulled up recently, just kind of at random. So we have things from Science of Genetic Engineering, Genetic Modification, Frankenstein in the Age of CRISPR-Cas9. Right, so that's a fairly serious topic. Then we also have somewhat more lighthearted topics like why fast food chains sell Frankenfood, or oops, I created a Frankenfood monster, how we made Nutella lasagna. The concept, so the prefix Franken is everywhere. The concept of Frankenfood has actually become so rich, there are actually two meanings of Frankenfood already in just a few years. So we had the original concept of Frankenfood as genetically modified organisms, but now there's this whole second category of Frankenfood, which is just taking two different foods and mashing them together like a Frankenstein's monster, stitching them together, whether that makes any sense or not, like Nutella lasagna. So really, this is a rich concept and a rich part of our language that has been evolving over the past 200 years. And so, you know, it's just one example of how stories can help make the abstract concrete, can give us a reference point for these conversations about abstract topics like ethics. They also provide us some data points, right? So there are plenty of real-life examples for why we need to discuss things like ethics, but those are often reactive in nature, right? We've done something, we've discovered something, and now we have to figure out ethically how to handle it. Stories give us a way to think out examples going into the future, think about possible scenarios that we might want to deal with ethically before they actually arise. And so Drs. Frankenstein or Moreau from science fiction will come to that conversation. There's also other areas where stories provide data points, such as discussions of theology, our understanding of how much the natural world can lead us to a faith in God. It needs to account for doctors like Dr. McCoy of Star Trek and Dr. McCoy of the X-Men, who are scientists who observe the natural world and maybe are skeptical about religious faith, and we'll talk more about them later. The other thing that I think makes stories useful is that they help make unfamiliar ideas accessible. I'll be talking about that in the second half of my talk in a little bit more detail, about how it works for science, so making things like chaos theory or machine learning a little bit more accessible by providing us some concrete points of discussion, and also for things like grace, natural theology. So we can take that science and then extend that and use that language from science that we were introduced to through science fiction and then talk about other topics in the science and faith discussion as well. So that's sort of the outline of where we'll be going from here, and mostly we're going to be going through different examples. So talking about the science and faith conversation, and some different examples from stories. We'll start with a classic, Star Trek. So Star Trek has hundreds of episodes of television now over the years, over a dozen movies. So to say that there's a single perspective on religion from Star Trek is overly simplistic. There are all kinds of examples. So these are just a few that come out of stories. So we can talk about, you can use Star Trek as an introduction to the idea that religion is just a cultural construct that loses its force in a multicultural setting. So the, you know, the people from Earth and other planets get on the Starship Enterprise, they go around to different planets, they encounter different cultures. Those cultures don't have the same religion. They don't believe in Jesus. They don't have the Bible. What does that mean? Does that mean that the Bible is purely a manufactured human construct or not? Well, it's a fictional setting. We don't know that that's actually what would happen if we went to other planets, but that's certainly how a lot of people think about what would happen when we went to other planets, and so that's a way to discuss that. And of course, certainly on this planet, in real life, we go into different contexts and discover different religions, and so we can have that conversation as well. There's also a notion in Star Trek of religion as the thing that we use to explain what we don't understand, or religion as an expression of our ignorance. And that's what that picture, I don't know how well that picture comes across. It's a still from the recent movie Star Trek Into Darkness. Kirk and Spock. Kirk and Spock are on a planet of a relatively technologically primitive society. They're just meant to be there to observe and to collect some materials that they need. And their spaceship takes off. The people on the planet observe their spaceship taking off. They're not supposed to have done that, but it was an emergency situation. And all of a sudden, a new religion springs out of this observation. They don't know what this ship is. They don't know how it got there. They don't know how it can fly off into the atmosphere. So it must be important. It must be worthy of reverence and worship. And so they're scratching an outline of the ship into the ground to remember it. And the implication is that now their religion is going to be based around the starship that they've observed. And it's an expression of their lack of understanding of how, you know, what was actually going on. So we can have that conversation about what whether that is a function of religion. Is that how religion actually operates in the real world? And of course, other topics come up from Star Trek as well. This is just a sample, like I said. Star Wars, another popular classic story, right? And there's all kinds of things about Jedi, whether that represents sort of a Buddhist religion, pantheism, panentheism. But I think one of the interesting things about Star Wars, it gets overlooked a little bit because it's an unpopular aspect of the story, is how it allows us to talk about the interaction of the natural and the supernatural, and whether, in fact, those are even useful categories to separate. So there's this concept in the Star Wars of the Force that binds everything together and that the Jedi can use to do all sorts of impressive tricks. And one of the prequel movies introduced the idea that the Force is mediated through these intracellular symbiotes called midichlorians. So there's this quote from Yoda that explains that all that surrounds us is the foundation of life, the birthplace of what your science calls midichlorians, the foundations of what connects the living force and the cosmic force. So this interaction that people have with this thing called the Force, that's sort of a spiritual, nebulous sort of thing, is mediated through these, you know, intracellular organisms that can be studied under the microscope. And everybody hated that when that was introduced to the mythos of Star Wars. We like the idea of, you know, a nebulous, mystical spirit. We don't like the idea of something that we can study with science, and especially not biology. And it turns out, actually, very recently, George Lucas let slip for possibly the first time, went on the record that if he had been allowed to make additional Star Wars, if he had decided to make additional Star Wars movies instead of selling it to Disney, he was going to go into the microbial world and explore these midichlorians in great detail, and that's what the whole three movies that we would have gotten would have been about. Personally, I'm a little disappointed that we missed out on a microbiological trilogy of Star Wars, but I think I'm the only one besides George Lucas who was disappointed by that. But I think it's a, you know, it's a great image of symbiosis as being at the core of what we do, and also just a, you know, a very incarnational picture of our relationship to the supernatural or the spiritual or that we don't understand. So I think that's another interesting place for conversation. Your mileage may vary. As I said, most Star Wars fans, not big fans of the midichlorians. All right, so that's Star Trek and Star Wars. Lots of people are familiar with those. Other thing that I'm a big fan of is comic books, superhero comic books. Maybe not as familiar to everybody, but let me tell you, there is plenty of theology in comic books and the comic book movies these days. And part of that is because the pantheons of Greek, Norse, Roman gods, they're great, cheap, free, public domain intellectual property. And so most of the gods and goddesses and heroes of Greek and Norse mythology have made their way into comic books. And so you get some interesting things, like this story in comic book called The Incredible Hercules recently that was all about how there was a transition going on from the age of monsters and superstitions and, you know, superstitious obedience to the gods. And they needed a transition into an age of reason and math and science. And there's this kind of climactic speech in the middle of it in which two characters are talking about how mankind needs to evolve past these things. That speech is delivered by Athena herself, actual literal Greek god of wisdom. Right? So she is a real person in this universe that all of the different scientific characters, like Dr. McCoy that I mentioned earlier, all kinds of scientists in the world of Marvel Comics, who have interacted with these gods. If not Athena herself, then Hercules, Thor, some of the, you know, you name it, they've met them, they've been to heaven, they've been to hell, they've been to all kinds of different versions of hell from different mythologies, and yet they still remain skeptical, and they still have these ideas of, oh, that's just superstition that we need to move on from. And so it's an interesting point of conversation, right? What does it mean for these folks who have a much more empirical experience with what we would call supernatural or religion, and still thinking that they need that it's irrational in some fashion or non-empirical, and how that reflects our current attitudes, how it reflects our own attitudes, and whether that makes any sense in that context at all. Another great character, maybe not explicitly dealing with science and faith issues, but dealing with this sort of questions of having different identities in different spaces that I think we can relate to, is a character called Ms. Marvel, another Marvel Comics character. So her real name is Kamala Khan. She's a first-generation Pakistani-American teen. And so she's dealing with all of those issues of what does it mean to be Pakistani and American? What does it mean to be Muslim in a largely Christian society? What does it mean to have these conservative moral values from my parents and from my religion in a, you know, high school, teenage context where not everybody has those same questions? How do I deal with those different communities that I'm a part of? How do I integrate all these things, or how do I have to choose between those different communities? And I think, personally, I find a lot that I relate to, even though superficially I have nothing in common with this character, other than the fact that we're both from New Jersey, which is fun. The panels that I have there are from a story where she gets to the point where she feels pulled by all these different communities to the point where she actually goes into the lab and makes like clay copies of herself that she animates through, you know, science, and sends them off to those different spaces and those different communities to represent herself there so that she doesn't have to be there, because she can't be in all those places at once. She feels pulled in those different directions. And here you see it where it's just starting to break down. The clay figure of herself that's at home with her family just starts to melt before their eyes, and they're all horrified because they think it's their daughter or their niece or what have you. But that's how this pull of different identities is broken down for her. So that's just a sampling of stories that might help you to start a dialogue in different aspects of the science and faith conversation on the more theological side. But there's also plenty of science in science fiction. I know there's also plenty of goofy science, pseudoscience. You know, you can follow Neil deGrasse Tyson on Twitter and get all the commentary on how science fiction gets it wrong. But there are also places where it gets it right, or where it at least helps to begin to explain some of concepts. And again, that goes back to Frankenstein. So something that was relatively recent discovery in the era of Frankenstein was the idea of galvanism, that you could use electricity, itself a relatively new and novel phenomenon, to animate dead muscle tissue. And so you could go and electrocute a frog's muscles and watch the frog's legs twitch. And there was a whole cottage industry of folks who just went around and performed this for people. Right? And supposedly Mary Shelley either saw or was aware of these performances and wrote that into her story. And that's actually one of the things that inspires Dr. Frankenstein to undertake his experiment to reanimate an entire person with electricity. I also highlighted here this quote about presentation threw greatly into the shade the previous natural philosophers that he had studied, just to show you that even 200 years ago, people were throwing shade. Nobody gets that joke. Okay. Only my kids got that one. So, other more recent examples. The movie Ant-Man a couple years ago. There's a new Ant-Man movie out, but this is the first one a couple years ago. And just an interesting opportunity to discuss how science is done. So Ant-Man, movie that includes ants. One of the things that comes up in the discussion of ants is the Schmidt Pain Index. Turns out that's a real thing. Dr. Schmidt put together an insect sting pain index, ranking the pain involved in different insect stings. Anybody want to know how he knows that? He tested it on himself. He let all of these different insects bite and sting him and ranked them based on his subjective experience. This actually won him the Ig Nobel Prize a couple years ago for his work. So we got some kind of reward for it, and it made it into the film. So that's a great way to just start to talk about how does science get done? How do we know these things? Well, somebody has to go out and measure it, observe it, figure it out, and sometimes that means getting your hands dirty. And as somebody who did mosquito collecting for my PhD and got stung by a lot of mosquitoes, not intentionally, that one connected a lot with me personally. So that's Ant-Man. Another great story for just sort of introducing science sort of right there on the page is another comic book called Squirrel Girl. Squirrel Girl has both the powers of squirrel and girl, and in her case, one of the powers of girl is being a computer science undergraduate student, to the point where she actually spends time in computer science lecture halls. So in this panel, they're actually giving a lecture on the ACID properties of databases, how to ensure transactional integrity. And there are several pages of explaining exactly how the databases work. It's probably the most explicit example, but there are other places in the story where it talks about C++ programming, providing detailed syntax, things like flow control. How do you write a program? How does it flow through its different processes? And just generally, how do you think like a programmer? So even when she's not at the computer terminal, part of her superheroing and the solutions that she comes up with just illustrate how a computer programmer might tackle a problem, how they might break it down into different parts and then approach it. So it's a great way to introduce computer science. And it's right there on the page. You don't have to go looking very far for it. Another one that's a little bit more of a mixture of things that are right there explicitly in the text and things you have to dig a little bit deeper into is the mathematics of chaos theory in the movie and the story Jurassic Park. So you may recall the character of Ian Malcolm is played by Jeff Goldblum in the movie. He talks about chaos theory in terms of one property of it, which is called, in the mathematical literature, sensitivity to initial conditions, which means that tiny little differences in how something starts can lead to big differences in the end. And so I have here an animation, if I can get it to work, that illustrates this. So I've colored the different dots here in their starting positions, and they all start, the different colors are close to each other. And over time, they'll get mixed up so that the different colors are actually spread all throughout the shape. And that's what we call sensitivity to initial conditions in chaos theory, and that's explored pretty explicitly in Jurassic Park, where Ian Malcolm says, look, things are gonna go wrong, you don't know how things are gonna evolve because little tiny differences that you can't control are going to lead to big changes. But the other aspect of chaos theory is, as you saw in that animation as well, there are these stable structures that can emerge over time, where no matter how you perturb the system, it's actually going to trend towards what they call an attractor. In this case, that particular sort of crescent shape, that over time, it's just going to keep coming back to that shape. And that's expressed in the story, not explicitly in mathematics, but in Dr. Malcolm's repeated expression, life will find a way. No matter what happens, life is going to persist. Life is one of these stable patterns. So now we can actually, so I find that helpful not just as a way to illustrate the science itself, but also then to take that science and start to talk a little bit about some theological topics as well. So in my mind, this is kind of a model of how grace and God's plan for our lives can interact with each other. So we have this notion of sensitivity to initial conditions, right? So the particulars matter, and there's some real freedom in the system, right? There's an opportunity to make a slightly different choice and have a different outcome. At the same time, there is a plan overall shaping the system, and that plan includes grace, because the plan can be accomplished in multiple ways, and little perturbations of the system will ultimately lead back to the same outcome in a broad picture. So I find that that's just a helpful way to start that conversation, and it's a useful illustration of how I think about these things, and it's actually helped me to think a lot about being more gracious in my own life. So that's Jurassic Park and chaos theory. Another example comes from of machine learning, another computer science topic, comes from X-Men comic books. So in machine learning, we're trying to build a model that fits data in some fashion. And I've illustrated that very crudely. We're trying to fit these blue points with some kind of a line. And the green line is a parabola that fits very well. The red line is what we call an underfit line. It doesn't fit very well. And the problem from this line is that the kind of solutions that we're allowing that line to take on just don't represent the full possibility of what the data can actually do. So there's some weakness, or there's something missing in our universe of possible models when we just fit that one that don't cover the entire data. And that comes up in this particular X-Men story where the villain, Mr. Sinister, actually uses an evolutionary algorithm to try to figure out what the heroes, the X-Men, are going to do. And he figures, well, if I can predict their every move, then I can anticipate it, plan for it, and have some counter move available to me, and I'll just win every time. What he forgot was that his name is Mr. Sinister, the comic book is called X-Men, he was never going to win. There are things, the X-Men have additional members that he didn't include in his planning. There were things that his solution space was not able to account for, and so the X-Men are able to do things that he just never thought they could, never considered that they could even do. So his model was underfit to the data. Curiously enough, and I don't think that this was planned, but I don't know because I don't work for X-Men comics, at roughly the same time, there was another story going on in a different title that illustrated the opposite problem of overfitting, where now our models are so expressive that we can fit every feature of our particular data set so well that we fit perfectly or almost perfectly, but we can't generalize that in any fashion. We can only cover that particular data set. And now my red line, instead of just being a straight line that doesn't fit really any of the data points, now I've got a nice complicated polynomial that fits all the data points. But once it gets outside of those blue points that I'm interested in, it's all over. It's nowhere near the green line that represents roughly the true model. And again, in this story, we have some antagonists who are so obsessed with the past of the X-Men and the past history of previous villains' plans that they copy in very minute detail, down to the costumes that those previous people were wearing, to make sure that they have copied everything just down to the last dot I and the last cross of the T to copy it. And it doesn't work because the kids don't repeat the mistakes of their predecessors. The X-Men kids don't repeat the mistakes of their predecessors. They can learn. They can do something a little bit different. And so, again, a failure to understand the principles of machine learning get the villains of the X-Men in the end. I find, again, this is an interesting and useful topic to introduce because it can help us talk a little bit about how the Bible and our Christian tradition and science can talk to each other and how we can bring those two together. The Bible and the Christian tradition can kind of provide the shape of our models so that we avoid the problem of just not having anything to shape our predictions and anything to shape our understanding of the world, just sort of letting us be carried by whatever the data send us. The science is one way, not the only way, but one way you can get some data about how the world actually works, how reality actually works, so we can fit of all the possible theologies that we can get out of our Christian tradition and our Bible, that we provide a little bit of concrete connection to the way that the world really works. Again, there are other ways to get to that point, but I think that's a way of thinking about perhaps how science and Christian tradition can interact in a fruitful way. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over this last example, but if there are questions folks have, we can come back to it. So just in conclusion, hopefully I've given you some illustrations, some examples of how stories are relevant to faith and science conversations in general, how stories can illustrate particular scientific concepts, both in the text, so right there, you know, explicitly on the page, or in the subtext of what's going on in the plot of the story. And then also how those scientific concepts can give us some new language to then talk about theology in a different way as well. And if you have any questions, happy to take them. Here's, if you have more questions later, how you can get in touch with me. I mentioned my blogging for InterVarsity. You can find that every week on Wednesday. And there are plenty of other great folks who write there as well. And you may have seen my book over at the main hall. It's available now and 50% off at this conference. They'll be back tomorrow to sell it. The folks aren't here today, but they'll be back tomorrow with more copies for sale. And that's it. Thank you.
Good. 5 minutes for questions.
5 minutes for questions? Okay. Sure.
It's actually not a question. It's a comment. I read fiction for young adults, and there's a lot of exploration, actually, of ethical aspects of science. So I had a conversation with Noreen yesterday at breakfast. Just there is, I think that won the National Book Award or was a finalist, House of the Scorpion, discusses cloning. And there's another book where teens are marginalized in that society. They can be rented by rich older adults. And this girl rents herself out and she's committed a crime during that time. And I read another series just recently about where, you know, abortion is illegal, problem teens can be harvested as long as all their organs are being used. So then that's okay. They're not dying. They're still living on in someone else. Anyway, so for whatever it's worth, for people who are interested, some of it's ethical possibilities and problems of what may happen quite a while down the line are being explored, and teens are thinking about this.
Okay, great. Thank you. So for the record of the recording, that was House of the Scorpion?
Yes.
Okay, and
That's
then possibly...
Others.
Okay, and other books for young adults exploring ethical questions of scientific research and biomedical ethics. Yes?
If we're making suggestions, the other one would be XKCD.
Yes, okay.
There is nearly always an XKCD that is relevant to whatever it is you wanted to say, and it's only one page. You've got to find it, that's all.
Right, yeah, so yeah, I think that's an axiom of the internet these days, is that there's always an XKCD comic for it. And if not, then there's a What If XKCD, which is the companion series that explores science topics in much more technical detail.
Have you ever thought of being the author of your own comic series?
That is a thought that has gone through my head since I started reading comics in junior high school.
Okay.
It has never come to fruition. I've never had the artistic skill, or I've never developed the artistic skill to go with that. And so...
I think I know somebody who can help you.
Yeah. So I'm open to exploring that possibility.
Okay. I mean, I think that the reason I'm interested in that is because it's a medium that has intrinsic authority with a certain subset of our culture that in some cases isn't paying attention to established institutions. You know, I don't mean to put too fine a point on that, but if the medium itself has already got some traction, then, and if, like you say, the ideas are sometimes, the ideas of science could be presented, ideas about lots of other things might find their way into comic story presentation and become part of the way people think about the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And I didn't have a chance to get into it now, but there's also actually a whole realm of nonfiction comics that are more intentionally educational or discursive in that fashion on scientific topics, on history, on biography, all kinds of things. So that's another great direction to go in. You know, it's a nice visual medium that also allows you to put text for things that are too abstract for those visuals.
And graphic novels.
Yes, comics and graphic novels.
I'm reading a book. I think the gentleman's name is Peter Kreeft out of Boston University, called The Philosophy of J.R.R. Tolkien or The Lord of the Rings. He has a very interesting premise. Of course, he has a lot of favorability towards Plato. That stories that are rightly reflecting the way the world is hang with us. They have an internal light, an internal truth that point us and help us evaluate in really interesting ways philosophical viewpoints. Do you have a comment on that based on what you've studied with?
Right, so I think the way that I would think about that, because of where I kind of come from, is that stories can represent one of these stable attractors, right? That our minds are drawn back to particular patterns in stories, and they persist even if they're told in very different forms. I mean, you can get down to the school of thought that there's only five basic plots, or there's seven basic plots, or however many you want to count them. But yeah, there are these persistent patterns of human behavior, human nature, that are hard to ignore, hard to get away from, and so they persist in stories. And I think that's a valid thing, whether that's a reflection of the quirks of human consciousness, whether that's something about greater reality in general, that's for philosophers to discuss. But yeah, and it looks like that's our time for questions.
Thank you, Andy.